My name is Nathaniel. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 7th, 2007. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I sponsor men who sponsor other men. I'm just a link in a chain. And that's how I was taught to introduce myself. I've got some notes just to keep me on track, because I kind of live by one of the maxims I've heard in here, which is it's okay to look back, just don't stare. So I don't do a lot of staring back anymore, but in order to do this, I had to stare back this afternoon, and that's a little uncomfortable. Anyway, I was born in the mid-60s in South Florida. My grandparents had started a resort in the 1930s, and my dad was kind of running it. When I was about five, my father was appointed to a government position, and we moved to D.C. for about 4 years. And when we moved back down, I would say I was, you know, pretty clean cut kid. I was an altar boy. I was a Boy Scout. Alcohol was served at family gatherings, but I had an experience similar to one of the stories in the Big Book, where I took a sip of wine, you know, when I was like six or seven, and it made me feel odd, like really odd. And so I didn't do that at family gatherings. But I was around alcohol a lot. Neither of my parents were alcoholics, but their parents were alcoholics. And I had aunts and uncles on either side who were alcoholic. One of my uncles died with 38 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's the only one besides me. And I have about 15 cousins who've been in and out. So when I was about 13, I was raped at a Boy Scout jamboree, and I pretty much stopped being an altar boy at that point. That pretty much convinced me there wasn't any God, or anyway, I wasn't interested in examining how that could work. So I had long hair suddenly. And I was, all I cared about was surfing and skating and being full of malice towards others. When I was 15, I was sent away to prep school up north. And I don't know who was happier that I was going, me or my folks. I just purely hated everything and everybody, and everything and everybody sure knew it. I'd always kind of felt like a fish out of water, because growing up on this resort, there'd be families coming down for vacation time, and then I had friends from school locally. So I kind of felt like I had a foot in both worlds and didn't really belong in either. And when I got to prep school, man, I had zipperhead hair down to my shoulders and a puka shell necklace, and everyone else was from New England and New York and looked like I do right now. And over the course of my first year, my uncle turned 50, and I went to his birthday party. And somehow I got into a wine chugging contest with a cousin of mine. And by the third glass of wine, I mean, the lights were on. And I kept going. And that night, I was sick in every way you can imagine. And my parents were pretty upset, and the next day, when I was able, my dad sat me down and had a liquor talk with me, and he said, you know, the thing with liquor is, you know, when you have a cocktail, it's great to enjoy, one helps you relax, but I find when I have, like, two cocktails, I hear a little bell go off in my head that tells me to stop, and he's like, you got to listen to that bell. Well, I heard that bell. But it was like the opening of a stock exchange or a horse race bell. You know, I knew what the bell was. So anyway, I cut my hair, lost the puka shell necklace. My first year at prep school, everyone had been staring at me. Sure, I was on drugs and alcohol. But now I look like this. You know, I was drunk a lot. Nobody, you know, nobody looked at me second, gave me a second glance. I pretty much was drinking on weekends, every weekend by my sophomore year in high school. And by my senior year, it was about a couple times during the week as well with friends. We went to great lengths to get liquor, and we were able to. My story does involve other issues, so I'm sorry if that's a problem. When I was 18, I slipped on some ice for my 18th birthday and snapped my knee. And it was operated on, and I was put in the hospital, and they shot me up with liquid Demerol. And that's how I wanted to feel for the rest of my life. And the Demerol would wear off. So I had a buddy, bring some school books to me in a backpack, along with a bottle of vodka and my bong and some weed. So I was drinking and smoking weed in the hospital waiting for my next Demerol shot. You know, that's me at 18. So I went away to college and failed out my second semester because I was majoring in drinking. My folks didn't really want me home. It was an odd thing. You know, most people, the school gave me an opportunity to come back, and I turned them down. And I went to work for a family friend in DC for a year as a mailroom clerk. And over the course of that year, someone in the office, my superior, she turned to me one day and she said, "What are you doing here? You need to be in college." Well, getting back into another college after I'd failed out of the one was really hard. So I started in community college and worked my way up. And I was getting semesters here and there. And I was just drinking on my parents' tab at the resort most of the time, because I was now back in Florida, and then taking my classes, and maybe spending an odd night down at the dorm, but coming back to their house. And so they asked me to leave. And in a typical, rational sort of decision, I took a geographic cure and I moved to Burlington, Vermont, which is right up at the north end of the country. And I lived there for 8 years. And I did various jobs, everything from working at a college cafeteria to driving a cab. I'd met some filmmakers traveling in Africa with my family. And one of them contacted me sort of out of the blue and said, "Hey, you want to come over and haul things around for me while I shoot this film on snakes?" And yeah, that was great. So I went over and I did that. I worked on a film. I did that a couple of times. And in between those trips to Africa and working on a film, I was back in Burlington, Vermont. And, you know, I could stare at a guy pointing a gun at me. I could stare at a wild animal ready to kill me. But going to the supermarket terrified me. You know, I'd have a panic attack. None of it made sense. I started going out with a girl who said, "You know, I think you're an alcoholic." And to prove her wrong, I said, I can go a year without drinking. And so I went to an AA meeting because I figured y'all would tell me, you know, how I could stave it off for a little while. And I heard some things that blew my mind. I heard people talking about how they'd always felt less than. I heard about the egomaniac with the inferiority complex. I heard about the allergy, and a lot of that made complete sense to me. But then I heard you all talk about being completely sober. And that made absolutely no sense to me. So I stopped going. I didn't drink for a year, but I did everything else you can imagine. Inhaled everything. And the last 2 weeks of that, I remember as being so uncomfortable, because I was anticipating the drink. I got through the filmmaking, I got a job at National Geographic Television in DC. And I moved down here, though I kept a house, my house, I couldn't sell it, wasn't in good shape. And I moved to DC, got a ghetto apartment, and worked at National Geographic TV. And I met my future wife then. She was a friend of friends of mine, and she was a UVA graduate, and she was a heavy drinker, and that was great. I wasn't drinking a lot at the time because I was working so much. I mean, I had to be up at 5:30, and I work late, so it was somewhat under control. But she would get really wasted, and so that was fine with me. It helped me fly under the radar. at that time, I would like bring home a pint every night and drink the pint. And that would just force myself to stop. That was all I had in the apartment. That's all it was going to be until the weekend when I let my hair down a little more. We got married. And then we moved back to Vermont because I was getting ready to be moved up in the organization. And I found out I didn't have a college degree. And I said, you come back when you do have one. So I went and finished up school in Vermont, was accepted at a small college. And my professors there decided I should be a writer and apply for writing fellowships at different universities. And I did. And one of them I was accepted to was UVA, which made my wife and my in-laws very happy. And we moved down to Charlottesville. I'm going to start this program. My wife was newly pregnant. Everything was great. My daughter was born with an interior birth defect called a diaphragmatic hernia. She was perfect on the outside, perfect. But on the inside, things were all mixed up. She lived for about 4 months. Because I was at school and because the program was very permissive of my situation, I was allowed to, we were allowed to be at the hospital all day. I didn't have to make my classes all the time. And we were at the hospital all day, every day. And I don't really think at that time, I still wasn't sure about God, but I venerated science and I was sure. No matter what they told me, no matter what percentages they threw at me, I knew she was going to live. She was just like me, you know. She looked okay on the outside and she was broken up on the inside, but she died. And, that kind of broke both of us. And for about 6 months, I was mainly trying to keep her from killing herself. And both of us were drinking heavily. And then at the end of 6 months, she said, I want to get pregnant again. And I said, okay. And we went through that fear session and a healthy son was born at UVA. And I graduated UVA with a job. And we moved to South Florida, where I started work at a small university. I drank a pint on the way home every night. I loved my son. I loved spending time with him more than anything. I loved my wife. But I had to have that pint in me before I could face them in the evening. I had to have that ease and comfort in me. I hid my drinking from my wife. I had bottles, you know, hidden in the house, and she'd find them from time to time. There'd be a fight, there'd be a spat, and it would blow over, and it would inevitably happen again in a year or so. My daughter was born when we were down there, my second daughter, and we hadn't wanted to know the sex. My wife had been sure it was a boy. When it was born a daughter, it was overwhelming. I had to go immediately into the bathroom and drink a half pint of vodka. It was too much for me. We moved to Virginia. My grandmother died and I sold some land and we moved to Virginia to her hometown over the mountain. And I was going to write the great American novel. Well, I didn't really do any writing. I messed around on a tractor. I shot things. I raised my kids and I drank. I had bottles all over the property, under stone walls and in hollows of trees. And I drank. And through a combination of mixing, you know, when I got a prescription from a doc that said, do not mix with alcohol, to me that meant, ooh, something different. And one time that didn't work out very well. And it worked out really badly. With me just falling all over the house and knocking things over. And my wife had had enough. And she said, you got to go to treatment. So I went to a treatment center out in the Midwest for 28 days. I identified myself as an alcoholic. I came home and started going to meetings. I got a sponsor who I never called. And I really like going to meetings, and I kind of like some of the literature. I like the 12 and 12. But I really couldn't identify. I mean, people were talking about losing families, crashing cars, and going to jail. And I just identified out. None of that stuff had happened yet. After a year of this, of just kind of going to meetings, a lot of meetings, but nonetheless, just going to meetings, not doing any work, my wife asked me to leave. The center of my identity had been being with the kids all day long and being with her. And in a way, they were also my only guardrails. And when I moved into an apartment in town by myself, in a typically mature fashion, I said, well, hey, it clearly doesn't work if this is the family afterwards. And I started drinking. And I drank like I never had before. I started maintenance drinking around the clock. I don't know if anyone's been stuck with that, but that's a hell I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. That's waking up every 45 to 50 minutes to take a shot because it hurts so bad. It's not sleeping. It's not living. I ended up in a psych ward. They advised that I move somewhere else. I was familiar with DC, so I said, I'll move to DC and I'm going to get sober with a psychiatrist. So I entered intensive psychotherapy and they had me on Antabuse. They had me take it in front of the psychiatrist. This was in order so I could see my kids. And sometimes I took it in front of two doctors. And I discovered I had a talent for sleight of hand. I make that pill disappear and make them think I swallowed it and go home and drink. I also found out that Antabuse, I could drink the day after and it didn't make me as sick as it made some people. So that was fine. I got a DUI and they put me on probation for a year. No drinking. I couldn't do that. So I blew it a bunch of times. And I knew I missed meetings with my parole officer and I knew they were coming for me. And I just drank and drank until I thought I was drinking myself to death. And when I knocked on the door, I grabbed something and cut myself. I don't really remember it. And I came to in a psych ward and, after a couple of days, they transferred me to the psych ward I'd been in before. And they weren't happy to see me. They said if I ever washed up on their shores again, they'd see me transferred somewhere else. And that was kind of my white light experience where I was like, I got nothing. I got no plans. I got no hope. I got no idea. It was like all of a sudden I was in this just white vacuum of nothingness. And something told me I better start doing what people were telling me to do. And so I agreed to go to long-term rehab, and I went to rehab for 3 months. When I got there, a lot of my fellow rehabbees thought I was a wet brain. I could not stand up straight. When we stood up to say a prayer at the end of the meeting, I had to grip forearms. I could not stand up and I stuttered really badly. All that slowly faded away and I came to my senses. After 3 months, I went to a halfway house with another guy, and we were required to have sponsors before then. So I had a sponsor. And he said, I know I'm just your temporary sponsor for maybe a month to 6 weeks before you go back east. But I want you to understand the first step because you don't have the faintest idea. I thought I did. I knew that when I took a drink, something happened inside me. And I couldn't stop. I knew that it made me feel better than anything on the world in the world until the last few drunks when it didn't anymore. Well, he sat me down a few times and he said, you know, he would say, you think you're an alcoholic because when you drink, you have no control over it. He said, no, wrong. You're an alcoholic because you always drink again. You know that. You know what happens when you drink alcohol and you drink again. Maybe it's a year, maybe it's a week, maybe it's 6 months, but you drink again. And you always have in the back of your mind that someday you're going to figure it out. And you don't tell anybody that. Oh, man. He knew me. And he used to say things like, you grew up around the ocean, you surf, right? You swam in the ocean. Did you ever fight the ocean, you know, as a kid, or just heave into a punch waves and all? What happens when you fight the ocean? You get pretty damn tired, right? You got a choice. You get out of the water or you drown. That's alcoholism, boy. You can't fight that for long. I mean, you can fight it. You can do it. You can hang on. You're going to run out of breath and you're going to get tired and you're going to sink under the waves. That's alcoholism. He took me to all sorts of meetings. He had me work at a food bank for service. And I heard my story everywhere. Didn't matter what kind of meeting we went to and what part of town it was in. I heard people talk about what I felt like. And I started to think, really believe. Like, if you all were like me, if you felt like me, and you came in here and things happened and you didn't feel like that anymore, but you wanted to live and you knew why, maybe that could happen for me too. Maybe. I moved back here and it had been suggested because I was a shut-in drunk that I start an IOP that would keep me accountable, keep me showing up. I was unemployable. So I started an IOP and they had a requirement, thank goodness, that I get a sponsor within 2 weeks, which really put a boot to my butt. And that saved my life, probably. And I was terrified about getting a sponsor, terrified. And I heard a guy share in a meeting once that it happened to be a really big meeting. And the topic was, what can you offer most as a sponsor? And this fellow shared that he thought that the best thing he could give was acceptance. Because when he came in, he felt unacceptable. And he felt like he could accept his sponsees as human beings and love them and offer that. And I thought, maybe this guy will take me. And he did. He asked me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, which I was in the middle of. And I said, okay, I'll start again. And he was like, whoa, I got a live one, as he tells me now. And we started into the steps. As I said, I had a pretty good idea of the first step. And I was still, I mean, my whole life was around AA at this time. The second step came pretty easy, at least for me. My higher power was you all and the program, because I could see results in front of me. And I knew I had been insane since I picked up the first drink and drank as much as I wanted. I'd been insane. And I was insane in a lot of ways. The third step brought up the G word again. And I was confused and resentful about that a little bit until it was pointed out that I had turned myself, my will and my life over to a higher power every time I took a drink of alcohol. And that higher power had been my higher power for 26 years, and it was alcohol. And I had no trouble with that. And I had to really accept that with myself. And okay, maybe I can give my will and my life over to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous under the guidance of my sponsor. And so my sponsor and his sponsor came over to my apartment. They told me they would support me in going through the steps. We said a prayer. They left. Nothing magical happened, but I sat there thinking, these two guys who have families just on their way home stopped to come here and talk to me and say a prayer. Like, they went way out of their way on their way home. And that impressed me. Started, as I said, getting involved in a little service work, setting up coffee, chairs. And I started to get to know people, because when people help you with something and talk to you, it's impossible not to respond. I just wanted to be part of the wallpaper. But I got to start to get to know a few folks, and a few folks started to get to know me. One guy latched on to me and sort of became a service sponsor. He'd heard a bit of my story, and he said, you need to be going in to 5 East at UVA Hospital, into the psych ward. And I know you can't go into the jail yet because you're still on paper, but you can go to a halfway house for guys who are getting out of jail. And so he had me do those things. And I was chugging along. At about a year sober, I met a woman on a blind date. And I don't know, she took pity on me maybe, but we've been together since then. And we went cautiously because we both had kids. I was finally able to see my kids without supervision at the end of a year. And it was a while before we introduced each other to the kids, et cetera, et cetera. But long and short of it is, I ended up with a whole other family, a stepdaughter who I absolutely adore and I'm so proud of, and a wife who still puts up with me. I don't understand that, but that happened in my second year. And I was chugging along, sponsoring guys, mm-hmm. and thinking, okay, I'm doing all right. You know, I'm doing okay. And I was at the hospital one day, and a friend I know approached me, and, you know, we did the handshake thing. But as he came towards me, he said, Nathaniel, the hand of AA is failing, and I need your help. That froze me in my tracks. And I said, well, what's going on? He said, there's a jail meeting we have, and my sponsor and I have been doing it for about 10 years, and we're old, and I'm sick. We can't do it, and we can't find anybody who will do it. Will you take this commitment? Yes, of course. So for 6 years, I went into the jail. I got other men to do it. And that changed my life so much. They just basically asked us questions. What do you, you know, what happened? What's it like? What's it like now? What do you do when this happens? What do you do when this happens? And when I was answering those questions, I started to realize, like, this is how I live now. This is how I live. So I used to joke that every Monday I would drag my ass over there and float out. It was a great experience. I found out in AA that when the phone rings at 3 a.m., no matter what it is, I'll show up for it. I found that out in a pretty horrible way that I don't need to go into. Early on, I got also involved in service outside of AA because that temporary sponsor in California who got me working at the food bank had said, there's no service outside your recovery, by which he meant anything you do to help another human being serves your recovery. You moron. So I worked at the Blue Ridge Food Bank for a couple of years, just, you know, moving carton and shifting things. And a friend of mine in AA got me to do that. And we were the same height. Well, he was like three of me wide, and he was African-American. So we looked a little different, but we were exactly the same. He was about 8 months ahead of me, and I loved him like I've loved few human beings. He was so great. He took me in, and he died alone and drunk in a dark room. His name was Art, and I still love him. That's what doesn't make sense to me tonight, standing here, is why I'm here. Anyway, with 4 and 5, I learned that I had been motivated my whole life by fear, that everything boiled down to self-centered fear with me. And it seemed to be this one particular fear, that I am unworthy of being loved. And I could see pretty damn clearly how most of the craziness I'd done in my life that didn't have to do with alcohol had to do with reacting to that fear. And I also learned, kind of to my consternation, that I'm just a garden variety drunk. And I'm not special. Not particularly awful or tragic. Happened to me, that made me an alcoholic, or nothing special or awesome happened to me in my recovery. I'm a garden variety drunk, and I'm on every page of this book. And this book has saved my life and still does. 8 and 9, 8 was, well, it was a process. One amends took me a long time to make. And then I went to my 30th high school reunion. I hadn't been to one of them. I was sober, and I just, what the hell? I was saying yes to life. I went. And on the way up there, I thought, oh my God, there's a guy in my class I owe an amends to. I beat him up pretty bad for no good reason. Oh my God. Well, there weren't too many of us that showed up, but that guy was one of them. And I made my amends, and it was not pleasant, or you know, in the Disney movie experience. He had held that pain for a long time, and it's still with him, probably, that fear that I caused. The first time I tried to make amends to my brother, he just refused it. He said, just don't drink for mom and dad's sake, and F off. A few years later, I became kind of a junior partner to him in business. The 10th step is where my sponsor has me live most of the time these days, keeping a close eye on myself through an inventory, and also the 10-step maxim that's in the 12 and 12. That talks about when anything, you know, when there's a disturbance, the problem is within me. And it's true for me. No matter how many disturbing things around me are happening, and disturbing things happen. My parents both died recently. My son turned out to be one of us, though thank God he's sober today and has been for years. The problem is with my being disturbed. And the problem is a little bit selfish. The problem is that if I'm disturbed, I might reach for alcohol if I get that disturbed, if I get that out of balance. As my sponsor says, you get that disturbed, you're going to drink. So you've got to quell that disturbance, and you know how. And I do know how. I pick up the phone. Usually I go and see someone in person. I still see my sponsor. I contact him once a week, and we have coffee or go to a meeting together, which is funny to me. because I have guys that I've sponsored for a few years, and I'm kind of a sino now, you know, sponsor and name only. I hear myself get referred to in meetings by some of these guys, and I'm like, well, that was like 6 years ago. Anyway, I love those guys. They call me when they need me. The 11th step, I came to see somewhere along the line that there was something moving, and all of you people, that all these steps and traditions and things didn't quite explain to me. That there was a power working in here and in me that was so greater than I could understand, and that it was okay to abandon myself to that path. It was okay to trust. It was okay to trust. And it was okay to look back and see, oh my God, I have been carried. Like I said at the beginning, I don't know why I'm still standing here. And so many friends that I've had aren't. But I'm losing a lot of friends now at my age who are dying sober too. And that's sad, but that's sadness of a different type. When you go to a celebration of life for an AA, you go to a celebration of life. I love you all so much for what you've given me. And I know that not everybody likes me, but I know that everybody loves me. I know that if I called one of y'all at any time of day, you would do what you could to show up for me, no matter what the situation. And I know that because I know it of myself. And if this selfish, self-centered SOB can know that about himself, then I know it's true of you all for sure. Because I got to be the most self-centered person in here. Of course. I guess that's as good a place as any to end it. I'm sorry if I've rambled. I haven't stuck to my notes. I don't know if any of it's made sense. I thank you all so much for asking me here tonight. This has been really good for my recovery to look back and just see where my feet are planted now and be so grateful for today. Thank you all. Yeah.